Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative and explore whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. The show has a topic hour where I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a range of subjects, and also this, the arts hour, where I interview guests from all areas of the arts. Well, this week I'm pleased to be featuring internationally renowned artist and author Enrique Martinez Celaya. This is the concluding part in a series of conversations I had with Enrique at his studio in Los Angeles in California. If you go to the show's website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, and click on guests, you can find the podcasts of the other conversations in the series there. Enrique is an award-winning artist who works predominantly in painting, but also in sculpture, photography, poetry, and prose. He trained as an artist as well as a physicist and invented several patented laser devices before abandoning physics for art. His artwork has been widely exhibited internationally and is held in the public collections of many international institutions. Enrique is the author of papers in art, poetry, philosophy, and physics, and several books. Born in Cuba and raised in Spain and Puerto Rico, Enrique began his formal art training at the age of 12 when he became apprenticed to a painter and developed an enduring interest in writing and philosophy during his time in Puerto Rico. Committed to the education and formation of artists, Enrique sponsors programs for children, provides scholarships for artists, and assists schools in developing their curriculum. In 1998, he founded Whale and Star Press, which publishes books on art, poetry, art practice, and critical theory. He's worked in collaboration with scientists, entrepreneurs, writers, musicians, and architects, including the Canadian rock band Cowboy Junkies, the poet and Nobel Prize-winning chemist Roald Hoffman, and the novelist Mary Rakow. His work has also been the subject of several monographic publications. He received a Bachelor of Science in Applied Physics and a minor in Electrical Engineering from Cornell University, and a Master of Science with a specialization in quantum electronics from the University of California, Berkeley, where he was a Regents Fellow. He attended the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture and earned an MFA with the department's highest distinction from the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he was also a Junior Fellow at the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center. He's the first person to hold the position of Provost for Professor of Humanities and Arts at the University of Southern California, is a Montgomery Fellow at Dartmouth College, and a Fellow of the Los Angeles Institute for the Humanities. I spoke to Enrique at his studio in Los Angeles, which is a huge light space with vast rooms both to paint in and display his work. The studio also has a beautiful lush garden featuring some of his sculptures. Well, let's hear some of our conversation. T.S. Eliot said, "If you aren't in over your head, how do you know how tall you are?" And I think this is a really evocative description of what it means to fully engage with one's art, because we usually think of being in over one's head as a negative thing. So I thought it was quite thought-provoking in terms of thinking about it, you know, how what one is truly capable of. And to me, it doesn't seem like a reckless act or an unconscious act. It's a way of recognizing that one has to leap into the metaphorical void sometimes. You said you don't use painting to express yourself, but in order to make discoveries. I'm just wondering, as part of that process, do you find yourself often in over your head with your work?
Yeah, I mean, the discomfort of having gone too far, of being in a little branch that you should never have stepped there, because everything that you know or you're familiar with or your areas of expertise are challenged or completely not useful anymore. I think that is the territory of art. Before that, when you're safe, when you know things, when you understand how to make something good, then you're in the territory of an art activity, but not art itself. Mm. I think art requires for you to be in the territory of the unknown, the unfamiliar, and where you are, chances are that you're just going to really fail and not being able to put things together as you hope you would. Mm. And there, in that kind of risk, is that the possibility of art happens. And I think, so it's very, very important, I think, to have to always go too far, farther than you thought you should. Mm. You know, if you were going to be reasonable and with good judgment, you would never go that far. And that's precisely what art ought to go.
Mm. Hmm. You've spoken about not getting too comfortable with your work, and if you are, then you shake things up. I'm wondering if you see a difference between feeling comfortable and finding peace or truth within yourself. I'm wondering if that distinction is necessary so one isn't just shaking things up for the sake of it.
I mean, shaking things up for the sake of it is actually quite comfortable because you are not really placed at risk. You're just kind of like you're either a provocateur or you are some sort of entertainer of sorts. But I think true discomfort where everything that you have known, everything that you think of yourself to be, is now a question mark. Mm. It's no longer of any use, maybe or of little use, where your foundation for your toolkit of sorts is now kind of useless. You're doing a task for which your usual toolkit is no longer useful. Mm. That kind of discomfort is important and critical to do something that surprises you in the deepest way. Mm. But shaking things up in a wacky way or sort of a trivial way is actually quite comfortable. And I think that there's a tendency sometimes in art and in our students to be all pose and opposition. You know, the pose of the provocateur, the pose of the crazy person. And quite often, the most interesting and most surprising part of these people is actually themselves and the whole creation they have made. But the work itself is quite safe. Even though it seems wacky, it is quite predictable. You can see where everything comes from, even if it's trying to be out of the box. The box is always hovering like a spirit over every choice that was made.
Mm. Mm. You've had quite a few different studios. I'm wondering what the studio means for you and whether it feels a transient space while you're occupying it.
No, it never feels a transient space, even if I move around. It always feels like a very, very permanent space, even if I only occupy it for a little bit. I think of a studio as some sort of incubator of the right ideas. Mm. I construct the studios not based on things I like or affectations or so on. I construct a studio to teach me how to work, to teach me how to live life better. So in some ways, the studio becomes somewhat like a ruler that I use to measure my efforts. Mm. So the studio, I never wanted to feel like, you know, like I like this cookie, so I'm going to make a studio that I like. That kind of liking something beforehand and you make it the way you like it. I like a little thing like this, I like a little thing like that. No, I want to create a studio that very much feels not like a cookie, but like a ruler. You make it here, and if I look at the studio the right way, I'll be able to gauge the quality of my effort. The studio will remind me constantly if I'm coming short of what I set out to do or not. So the architecture, the spaces are designed to be a constant confrontation with the aspirations that I like to measure myself against.
Hmm. That's interesting. You have painted high up on the walls near the ceiling in your studio the phrase, "Keep your actions faithful." To what are you being faithful?
It's a Buddhist idea that your thoughts and your actions and your words will be faithful to one another. Mm. In general, in life, it's very easy to think one way and act another and say something else. Mm. But in the art world, that challenge is in some ways magnified, because there is a tendency in the art world for people to say they stand for something when in fact they stand for something else.
Yeah.
And the activities of the studio to be, the studio not being the place that you raise yourself to a higher standard, but rather one in which you make more compromises out of fear, out of insecurity, than perhaps any other place in your life. So by having that there physically as a reminder, and I have other kinds of reminders throughout the studio, I catch it sometimes with the corner of my eye, sometimes, you know, never even realize it's there, but it's always hovering over the choices I'm making in the work and around the work, and in the kind of things that I'm trying to pursue with the work. And it's a difficult standard to maintain, but I can't imagine a better standard in the day-to-day activities to the studio.
To create art at the level that you do is an all-consuming pursuit. Accepting that is the case, I'm wondering how important it is to also keep a sense of lightness, of being serious about one's art but not taking oneself too seriously.
Yeah, I mean, I think that relates a little bit to what we were talking about before. I mean, I'm constantly reminded by the things I read or think about or see that I can't take whatever little success or whatever my work has had as any indicator of anything, really, because I'm well aware of what greatness looks like. I would never really be able to take myself too seriously in regard to that, you know. So in some ways, it keeps it fresh. It keeps one's vision of oneself with certain humility.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then in terms of, you know, there's always this fine line between, I think taking life seriously is important, but and taking oneself seriously enough to make certain obligations of oneself is important, but not so seriously that one begins to believe one's own importance or that one's solemnity or something like that. That's the kind of seriousness that ultimately it is anti-serious. It is not really serious. It seems like seriousness, but it's not.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my conversation with special guest, artist and author Enrique Martinez-Celaya, whom I spoke to at his studio in Los Angeles. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back with more of our conversation after these messages.
Do you like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
No white horses to play the game, and I wish I knew your name. Something about just that. I think that there's more to us than
just that.
It's a question of balance music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, artist and author Enrique Martinez Celaya, whom I spoke to at his studio in Los Angeles. And as I mentioned earlier, this interview is one of a three-part series of conversations with Enrique. If you'd like to hear the other two conversations, you can find them at the show website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. If you go to the guest page, you'll see photos of Enrique of the different shows. And if you click on a photo, it takes you to the podcast page where you can either stream or download the audio. And there's also photographs of Enrique's work on the podcast pages and links to his website. Well, right now, let's hear some more of our conversation.
Previously interviewed Ehab Shanti and Rama Chakaki, both champions of Middle Eastern art. And with both of them, I discussed how art can both reflect and shape conflict as well as give a more holistic voice to people living in countries that are often represented simply as troubled areas by Western media. Although the United States is not a conflict zone as such, we do have a lot of ideological conflict here and also geographical areas and groups of people who are presented as problematic and even effectively written off by the media. I'm wondering what role you think art might have in reflecting and shaping conflict in the US and perhaps giving the voiceless a voice. I mean, not necessarily right. Your own art, but just art generally.
I think art is not the most effective way to create political discourse and political change. I think art gives the voiceless a voice in a very private, singular manner, one-to-one. There are more effective ways to affect change or to bring to the attention of the world certain ideas than it is with art. Mm-hmm. Even though many people disagree with that, and you know, to put certain ideas on a gallery or a museum is really a self-satisfying mm-hmm. approach. Everybody feels good about it, the artist feels good about it, the visitors to the gallery museum, which are usually self-selected, feel good about it, but doesn't really, and there's no precedent of any art or very few art that have really make big transformation. But you can record, for example, we spoke about Goya, the shooting of May the 3rd. Now when we look at it, it's in the Prado, when we look at it, we feel the oppression of one individual. We feel the dehumanization of that individual. And in that sense, we connect with that individual and we feel sort of the universality of that. And in that sense, it gives voice to the oppressed, but it is a very specific individual thing, and then in turn, I can see that experience, and I myself in my life can begin to generate change in some manner. But I think that there is a certain feel good attitude about about these pontifications or these ideas that people put forth about art making change and this and that. And I think at the end of the day, a lot of it makes for very bad art and for very bad politics and for very bad social change while everybody's feeling good in the meantime. So I think what art can do better than anything else is to remind us of the human condition, to reveal to us where we are really, as both as individuals, as hearts, as consciousness, and to make us feel less alone and to deal with questions of solitude and so on. So when I read, for example, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and I look at a particular sense of oppression, at the end of the day, it's not a policy. It's not politics.
Yes.
It's me feeling in a very internal and private sense the oppression of another.
Yeah.
And that is what art can do best, a one-on-one. And that's why it's so dangerous to include numbers in art, like how many people were touched by this. It's really ultimately irrelevant. And, you know, and of course, all museums measure their success of how many people go through the doors for the particular show. Mm-hmm. So, which is a very, very...
Sort of gauging how deeply were the people affected.
Yeah. It's like they do, you know, museums do this, all these programs to try to get more people to come to it. And then they do, you know, say jazz night or family night or this and that.
Yeah.
So they get thousands of people through the doors and the engagement. And the idea is we just get them here and we just put them in front of art and it's an education. An argument could be made for that. But it's very different argument than to say, well, what is it that happens to them when they stand in front of their work?
Yeah.
And their works that will produce very few visitors. But that somehow will have transformative experiences for those visitors.
Yes.
And their works, I mean, if we measure things like, for example, in terms of numbers, then what we should just put in museums is Oscar-winning movies or something. And then everybody will come in huge numbers. So, and that would solve the problem.
Yeah. I'm very interested in the... iconography of memory, how each person has a certain set of memories that represent certain experiences. For example, when we think of it, if we're a seven or something, we have three or four pictures that come up, and it's usually always those pictures that come up unless there's a specific incident that, you know, provokes a different memory for some reason. Our memory is a curator, and I think I see painting sometimes in that sort of way of a choice of the icons to represent things. I mean, not in terms of symbolism, I don't mean that, but what we draw on. And I wonder if there's a connection for you between the iconography of your own memory and your work.
I mean, there are many, many images that I use that... that are connected to places I have been and things I have seen. Not because they are the end in themselves, not because I'm trying to sort of make a personal narrative, really, but because those are things that I can understand the poetry in them.
Mm-hmm.
I have been with them and I have known them enough to understand the nuances of them. So in some ways, those things seem like images that I would like to use. But there are images that I use precisely because they're unfamiliar. I only live, for example, in the winter landscape of snow and so on when I was in college and when I was a kid in Spain. But the otherness and sense of foreignness to that, this darkness of that quality, mark my feelings on my mind in a certain way. So when I use it often precisely because it is an otherness, a sense of the unfamiliar. Mm. Not solely for that reason, but that's one of the reasons I use it. So I think using iconography can have a sense of the known and at times the disruption of the unknown.
Thinking about what you said earlier about people coming through exhibitions and, you know, the number of people versus perhaps what people are feeling for the work, we're always looking to explain and understand life through the collective, and yet it seems to me that a deeply contemplative artistic approach to the personal can reveal as much, if not more, of the truth of being, because we can't all live grand lives, and I don't think we need to live grand lives to divine truth, and the truth doesn't need generalization to be validated. We can find it in our own individual lives. But I'm wondering what your thoughts are on personal and collective understanding.
I mean, I've never been good at the idea of collective understanding. I mean, some people are naturally politicians and they want to really change the mind of masses and so on. I'm interested in teaching, for example, which is a way to affect a relatively, bigger group than one, not a gigantic group, but a small group. So that I can understand, but I am always being very interested in individual encounter, individual transformation, partly because my own experience of being changed by a work of art or being challenged by a book has always been a one-on-one. While they are possibilities that can only be explored by the collective, for the most part, I find the collective to tend to be an averaging force. And collective, the consensus of things, what I find most often in consensus is what it leaves out. The nuance, that's true, but, and the little thing that goes around, which is often left out of the consensus because it complicates the story too much. I am quite interested in what complicates the story. You know, the political statement that seems right, but has this other things that we don't consider too much. That we don't consider is what I'm usually interested in. And that is usually, and quite often, the realm of the personal and the personally felt. And the grand statements are always a little suspicious for me. So I have gravitated towards primary individual experience.
With social media, there's a growing tendency, I feel, for people to be performing their lives rather than living their lives. There's a self-consciousness that doesn't seem to necessarily correlate with self-awareness. Narcissism is on the rise. You've said that the art world is at the centre of this extreme narcissism in society today. Why do you think the art world is a particular hotbed for this, and what is the antidote, do you think?
I mean, one of the reasons why I think the art world is can get away with narcissism, so let me start with that, is because this preoccupation with the image and the inflation of the image only lasts so long if you're a rocket scientist, for instance, because the moment you try to launch a rocket and it collapses, so much for the image of you as a great rocket scientist. But in the art world, you can actually survive for a long, long time, maybe forever, or forever during your lifetime, with an image if you are good enough at presenting certain ideas and in carrying yourself a certain way and surrounding yourself by the right vapid people, you can actually get away with surviving only on image with no substance behind it. And that tends to encourage the nurture of the image at the expense of the self, at the expense of what is really at play, of your real fears, of your real insecurities. And that tendency to starve the self at the expense of the image is sort of at the heart of narcissism. So narcissism, more than self-love, is ultimately the impossibility of self-love. You know, the trading of image for self, which, of course, social media is a fantastic platform in which to do that, because, you know, I might have five miserable days, but the one day that I am water skiing in just one leg is the day I put up in social media, and everybody thinks of me as an amazing water skier, and the next week I cultivate another thing. And I know the truth. So the more I put that image of myself as the amazing water skier, if I know the truth, and it begins to kind of hollow me more and more, because I depend, my value depends on the approval of others, how many likes, how many followers I have, and so on. So it's a trade-off of the real inner workings of myself and my life for the outer workings of social acceptance and popularity. And sort of art that depends on the approval of auction houses and the approval of exhibitions, on everybody saying that you're really good. Or I shouldn't say art depends on that. The currency of art depends on that. Naturally makes for a sort of a narcissistic approach, because it's often rewarded by that currency.
You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my conversation with special guest, artist and author Enrique Martinez-Celaya. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Ciao. I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda Yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Thank you.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, artist and author Enrique Martinez-Celaya, whom I spoke to at his studio in Los Angeles in California. Well, let's hear the last part of our conversation.
Arts in education is often underfunded in schools, and the arts are frequently seen as dispensable, a luxury, a hobby, or entertainment. Perhaps if we taught the arts differently and included them in education in a more integrated fashion, this might lead to a deeper understanding of what art can mean. I'm wondering how important you think the arts are in the school curriculum compared with subjects that people might think are more practical, and perhaps whether you think the way in which they are presented within the curriculum is important.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the arts are critical, but they're not often presented and taught as if there was something critical. Art is never, if I was treated more like religion and approached that way and taught that way, I think that it would be much easier to make an argument for the indispensable quality of art. Mm. But when it's treated as some sort of fun or distraction or creating textures or some sort of wacky process, then that's what you have recess for in schools.
Yeah.
So I think that we have two parts here to blame. We have the overall neglect of society as a whole for ideas that art has pursued over the years, but also we have a lot to blame in artistic communities themselves that celebrate a great deal of triviality that makes the general population say, well, I mean, who cares about that? I mean, I often say, who cares about that, when I see a lot of the biennials and so on. And I think, well, if I am a politician or if I am a school teacher that goes to some of these exhibitions, I find them to be quite trivial. So the reason why I should divert funds from science, for instance, to create more of that, it's not immediately obvious. Mm. Even though I myself can make great arguments for art itself, I'm not making an argument for art in a general sense. Mm. Implicit in any argument I make for art is always a certain kind of art, or a certain kind of way of approaching art with a certain level of commitment to truth and seriousness. Yeah. And so I have no argument to make for art in general terms. Because that will have to lump in a lot of the nonsense that I see put forth.
Yeah. As you were speaking, I was thinking, you know, perhaps part of it also is that we don't see art as a way and means of understanding the world, which is how we see science, and we see that as necessary. But perhaps also because the main function of our society now seems to be centred around money, there's also that aspect of it. If that is the main impetus in life, then that changes how one looks at certain things, of the potential of them to earn money rather than to be part of a sort of greater need to understand why we're here and what the world means. Do you think that's part of it?
Well, that's part of it. I mean, and in many ways, the art is valued, or an art is often measured based on the currency that you have in markets. Mm. But to make a counter-argument to it, for instance, no one thinks that, to use the example of religion again, that religion makes you any money. And yet still many people feel that it is something has to be committed.
Well, that's what I mean. It's just so disappointing that art isn't thought of in that way.
Yeah, I think that the cynicism of the 20th century, the cynical evolution of the 20th century, has something to do with that. Mm-hmm. But I also think the project of modernity has something to do with that. And I think that in many ways, what we have insisted that art is through much of what has happened in the last, say, 40, 50 years, I think it leads most people to question whether art can ever be an unconcealment of truth. I mean, it's just not the way it's ever thought of.
No.
So while I don't want to empower and give justification for all the reactionary politicians and so on that like to attack the arts, often which they don't understand, it is also true that art organization and artists and art institutions, the institutions of higher education that teach art in a way that is really embarrassing in many ways. Not all of them, and not every teacher, but some of them are. I mean, if a physics curriculum at the university will be approached with the same cavalier attitude that art curriculums are sometimes approached, physics, I think, will collapse. The fact that many art majors walk out of the universities with essentially no skills to speak of. They're told that they have some critical skills, but for the most part, they do not. No physics curriculum will ever be satisfied with having people who walk out of school without many skills and without any understanding how they're going to support themselves after they graduate. So if that is what seems to come forth from some of our higher education programs, what could we expect in the lower schools?
Yeah.
And then this is a reproductive system. So that's how people graduate and they go and get MFAs and then they could become teachers. And the system perpetuates this tendency to look at art as a repository of insecurities and fears rather than the means by which we can understand the world in a deeper way. And if we had that view, then I think we will value more his role in education, his role in our lives, and perhaps put more attention to it. But it's very difficult to make these arguments, even as somebody who believes in art very deeply, when you see what's happening in a lot of places. Not everywhere, but in a lot of places.
Yeah. If you look at the traditions of Eastern philosophy or even the more mystical Christian philosophy, the emphasis is on understanding consciousness and meaning through direct experience rather than intellectual proof, if you like. It seems pretty evident to me that we can never fully understand everything on a purely mental level. It's just too vast. And by saying this, I don't mean that we shouldn't use our intelligence and intellect for inquiry, but in the most recent centuries, using our senses and expanded awareness to understand the world has become frowned upon, if not ridiculed or feared. And art is one area where grappling with the unknowable through presenting personal experience and that which cannot be seen is accepted. And there's hope to me through this means of inquiry to actually know everything, but not in the way that science has put forward is the way to know. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think art... offers the possibility of a different form of knowing that eludes other ways of inquiry, like science or philosophy or mathematics, that Hegel placed art just below religion as a way towards absolute knowledge. And I think that there is the encounter with a work of art, with a great work of art, offers a very direct path to a very comprehensive knowledge that that eludes being named as cognitive or any of those things. That is not just sensorial knowledge. In fact, it's mostly not sensorial knowledge. It is a communion with a third thing. So there's the artwork, there's oneself, and then in that recognition, something occurs between both that becomes a third kind of entity present. And that is what, that is the kind of knowledge that art can offer or can bring about.
Because I think, you know, we spoke about this earlier a bit, but a lot of knowing is non-verbal, but it is non-verbal. Even a lot of thought, I think you said, is non-verbal. You know, we everything gets presented in words, but a lot of actually how we understand and know things is not put into words, or it's a combination of lots of different things. So that also seems to me why a solely intellectual route can't bring us to a point of understanding everything, or even hoping to.
Well, and also that word. So if we flip it, for example, we take something that only exists in words, like a poem. First line of Mending Wall or something, there is something that doesn't like a wall by Robert Frost. That simple little line there, everything that it points to is brought about by the words, but is way beyond the words. So even when something exists only as words, as in a poem, all that it points to and implicates and brings about and stirs goes far, far beyond those words.
That's true. So
I think that a work of art, whether it's work of words or the work of, you know, paint, for example, is invoking and projecting and opening a territory, and then as we move through that territory, something gets revealed and unveiled, and that experience, it's not that it's nonverbal, it's that it exists as such a totality that any facet of it, and one facet would be how you try to express it in words, is but just a little fragment of the total experience. And what the encounter produces is the total experience. When you try to translate it, then you are forced to give a little sliver of that total experience for somebody else's understanding.
Yeah, that kind of somewhat cliche of like a window on the soul. I mean, it is, any of these things are only a sliver, but they have the potential. And I would say that the greatest art, the potential is enormous. You know, you get that sliver and what comes from that is vast. Yeah. Your work is commercially successful. I'm wondering if you would have continued producing art if it had not been. And what would have motivated you? Obviously, I presume you would have had to have done something, you know, to live. But, you know, do you think you could have sustained remaining an artist without some degree of worldly recognition?
I think I would have. I mean, I did it before. When I was a physicist, I still made work. And I would always make work. Maybe not to the same scale or... certainly not to the same scale. But I would always have done something with art and with writing, no matter what. It's difficult. I mean, not everybody can be like Wallace Stevens, that, you know, running an insurance company or something and writing great real poems. That's hard to do. It's hard to do to be that serious while having a day job.
Yes.
But that being said, I have met many people who do it. Many people who are professors and very serious artists, but many people that sometimes hold a very different kind of job and do it in a very legitimate way. I would like to think that maybe I would have attempted to do that, but there's significant challenges, and I have a lot of respect for people who try to do this and don't succeed, because it is difficult to keep it up, especially if you have a family, you have another job, you come home tired, or you have all these demands.
Yeah.
So I don't have pass a judgment on anyone who tried to do this and even though they loved it, couldn't do it. I would like to think that maybe I could have to some degree, but it's difficult. It's difficult to do. Sometimes, you know, you feel like a phony as an artist if you have another job that is what you used to.
Certainly that's how people judge you. I think the world judges you like that. And that's hard to live with sometimes.
And, you know, the judgment of the world is hard, but it is also harder when you feel it in yourself that maybe you, in fact, are a phony because you use this other job. And if you have a family, you take money from that job and from your family to support your habit of of art. That's why it's so sad that sometimes politicians speak about, you know, the National Endowment for the Arts, back when the National Endowment for the Arts supported artists. Imagine that artists are getting all, you know, having these lavish livings on government support, when in fact most artists in this country have another job in order to support their work. So in other words, the big supporters of the art in the U.S. are artists who hold a second job in order to keep this country seeming if as though has an art sector. So I admire those people who have jobs at coffee shops or whatever to keep doing their work because they need it. And I think that's even if they make many compromises, it's still a heroic thing to do, I think.
Yeah. I was trying to think who said it. There's that quote, "Why do I make art? Because I must." And I think that is true of a true artist, that you can't move through life without engaging with it in a creative, artistic way. And what that may look like in terms of a career perhaps can differ for the reasons that you say, you know, and the choices that one makes. But
well, and that's something that is important to remember, because I think if you are doing it because you must and you're holding a second job to support yourself and you're still creating little lies in the studios and compromises and creating sort of fakes in there, it's particularly sad, because now you're doing something because you feel compelled to do it. You're doing it against all odds. You should, at the very least, make sure that you are doing as truthfully as possible, because that truthful approach is the absolute best testimony and best reverence you can give yourself for the effort you're putting towards doing it. I mean, you're sort of doing such a disservice to yourself if after you doing all that, you're still lying to yourself in the studio. That's not a good way to honor the effort.
No. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Well, thanks again to Enrique for making the time to talk to me. As I mentioned, this interview is the concluding part of a three-part series of conversations with Enrique at his studio in LA. So if you'd like to hear the other conversations, head over to the show website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, and click on guests to find the podcasts. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to you joining me again next time.